are about to listen to the Agnostic Salvation Hour.
Listen and be freed.
Hello, and welcome to yet another episode of the Agnostic Salvation Hour. For the purpose of this and the next several episodes, we will take a very in-depth and detailed look at Christianity and its merits. In the unlikely event that upon my death, I should awaken kneeling before a golden throne and accused of having failed to acknowledge the existence and eminence of the Christ God, I have prepared this defense. God, I stand accused of having failed to recognize your existence or worship at your altar. This is a charge that I do not deny, but what I do deny is that this charge is or could have ever been a crime. If you were to ask if I feared being judged in the light of justice and perhaps mercy, my answer is unequivocally no. For while I have on occasion done wrong, and certainly have not done good on each occasion that opportunity did avail, I was nonetheless, on the whole, a good person. I have never sought to do harm or inflict suffering, even on the rare occasions where justice did permit. It is not now nor has it ever been my nature to contribute to the suffering of mankind. As you know, I have spent a lifetime sheltering the weak from harm. This I can say with confidence. The world as a whole was better off because of my existence, if even just by the slightest of increments. I have regrets, of course, but if I am to be judged by my merits and failures, then I will happily accept the verdict that results. Unfortunately, if the Bible makes just one thing clear, it is that the God depicted within it is not a being prone towards kindness, justice, mercy, or restraint. And thus it is that I have cause for fear. It is now my most earnest hope that this depiction is either in error or grossly exaggerated. But if it is not, then I now suffer the indignity of being judged by the one being to have ever had the privilege of existence that has ever truly been guilty of a crime. If I am going to be condemned for the fact that I fail to recognize your existence, despite my earnest and ongoing efforts to do so, if I am to be condemned for honestly held beliefs and convictions, then I am to be sentenced to a painful eternity of contemplating the evil of your nature. Ultimately, my sin is to have failed to acknowledge the possibility that a being so great as to be able to create an entire universe from nothing, and purely by will, could conceivably be the monster depicted in the Bible. For this failure, I would offer no apologies. Even if it were possible to apologize for having failed to recognize the loathsomeness of one's character. In the end, my fate will be more a reflection of your nature than my guilt. An examination of miracles. As most of us are extremely well aware, most Christians will unhesitatingly look for virtually any excuse to declare an incident a miracle. I have for your examination two events where even the most ardent Christian cannot find a miracle. The first was a recent incident that made the news throughout the nation. On Sunday, March 8, 2009, a mentally ill man entered the First Baptist Church in Maryville, Illinois, as services were in progress, approached the minister, spoke a few words, pulled out a .45, and started firing. The first round fired was absorbed by the Bible that the minister happened to be carrying at the time. The next three were absorbed by the body of the minister. Fortunately, the gun then jammed. After a scuffle, during which three people, including the assailant, were stabbed. The assailant was eventually brought down by the parishioners and then, of course, taken into custody by the local authorities. We can all agree that this was a tragedy, and that the death of the minister was completely unjustifiable. And thus, I decided that from this tragedy, I would bring some good. So I opted to conduct a survey based upon the events of that tragic day. I described to 10 people an event in which a madman were to fire a gun at an ordained minister. The minister was able to block a bullet with his Bible. The gun ended up jamming. The parishioners eventually wrestled the man to the ground, and he is eventually taken into custody. I then asked if the event I described was a miracle. 6 of the respondents recognized that the incident from the news, and of course knew immediately that this incident did not end in a miracle. However, 4 of the respondents assumed that based upon the details that I had provided, a miracle did in fact occur. I asked why they believed the incident was a miracle. One responded that it just was a miracle and provided no further explanation of her conviction, while the other 3 essentially asserted that the bullet being blocked by the minister's Bible, followed by the gun jamming, was just too unlikely to have been anything but a miracle. They believed this despite the fact that a bullet, when fired, will strike the first thing in its path, and firearms are prone to malfunction when not properly maintained. Nonetheless, when pressed, they persisted in believing that a bullet being stopped by a Bible, followed by the gun jamming, could be nothing but a miracle. Later, when informed that the gun only jammed after the 4th round being fired, and that the assailant eventually stabbed 2 other Christians before being restrained, all 4 agreed that perhaps this was not a miracle after all. Regardless of the fact that after they were made aware of the additional details, the facts that they previously found so impossible and miraculous were still true. The 1st round was absorbed by a Bible, and the gun did jam. And when they believed that the minister had survived the assault, they considered these facts so unlikely that the experience could be nothing but short of a miracle. Perhaps they concluded that a God capable of magically deflecting the 1st bullet and later jamming the firearm was also capable of deflecting the 3 rounds that were fired in between. And the fact that he did not meant that these previously impossibly linked events were now just sad details of an even greater tragedy. Miracles come and miracles go. And sometimes they just don't come at all. Anytime a Christian survives an event where death was a possible outcome, it is generally assumed that their survival was only possible as a result of God's direct intervention, and thus a miracle. The next tale I have is of a former co-worker of mine who recently died due to cardiac arrest. The cardiac arrest was a result of a staph infection that went undetected for probably a month. The staph infection caused severe pain throughout her body, which on 3 separate occasions led her to see 3 separate doctors. On each of these occasions, the doctors failed to even suspect a staph infection, let alone treat it. An illness which could have been cured with a few rounds of antibiotics went untreated and resulted in the extremely premature death of a good Christian woman. While clearly no miracle occurred here in this situation, despite approximately 20 of her friends and family praying in earnest for her recovery, should we assume that this good Christian woman, who attended church twice a week and actually taught Bible study, was cursed by God? As I mentioned before, any time a Christian survives a situation that was even remotely life-threatening, it is automatically assumed that God saved her. However, what of a situation like this one, where the person, despite all the odds being in her favor, dies anyway? Does this mean that she was cursed? Or just a statistical anomaly, no different than those of us who actually beat the odds? My own life was once touched by an event that most who are familiar with consider a miracle. A car accident that I caused many, many years ago while traveling at speeds well beyond the posted speed limit. My car, at my direction, crossed the median that divided the eastbound portion of I-70 from the westbound, hit headlong a car traveling the opposite direction, flipped into the air, and rolled down an embankment. I woke several minutes later in what could only be described at that point as a twisted hunk of burning metal. I exited the vehicle and stumbled up the ravine back to the interstate completely unscathed. Everyone, whether on the scene or having seen the vehicle later, professed that my survival could only be described as a miracle. A miracle which left the responsible party in perfect health and an innocent westbound traveler with lifelong injuries. This incident, as tragic and traumatizing as it was my first clue that perhaps religion was based more upon our desire to explain improbable events than the truth. The notion that God found it fit to spare me from harm while allowing an innocent woman to suffer was nonsensical. How could have God gotten things so mixed up? I recall, after being told for the umpteenth time that my continued existence was a miracle, angrily shouting that if this was God's idea of a miracle, then he could keep them, because I had no need for them. I eventually realized that my continued health had far more to do with the design of the vehicle and the fact that I was wearing a seatbelt. Of course, countless studies have shown that God typically favors those who are wearing seatbelts when involved in high-speed collisions, and I, in that regard, was no different. I remember going over in my mind countless more efficient methods God could have employed if he had wanted to perform a miracle. I concluded that disabling my car earlier that day would have been a very effective method, but at the same time, the variety of miracle for which a God receives little to no credit and often a small amount of scorn. Ultimately, the notion that God would have waited until my car collided headlong with another before deciding to take action still angers me a bit, even in the knowledge that this really never was the case. As an agnostic, I have for years listened to my non-believing brethren engage theists in debate regarding the existence or non-existence of a God. In these debates, atheists, of course, take the position that there is not now nor has there ever been a God, and the theist defend the opposite view. Now, to me, this is a waste of time, and I very much wish that my fellow non-believers would cease their participation in these rhetorical displays, as they are a trap. Truth of the matter is that while a God very likely may not exist, this is a fact which cannot be verified. A skilled atheist can demonstrate that the existence of a God is not and was not necessary to explain our existence. But ultimately, proof that one actually does not exist cannot be found. By definition, one cannot disprove the existence of a non-physical entity that exists in a reality outside of our own. Again, being able to prove that the inclusion of a God is an unnecessary component in explaining our existence and that of our universe affects nothing, as the skilled theist will argue that while Occam's razor is effective at cutting away the fat, its imprecise use can also lead one to inadvertently cut away the meat as well. They will argue, to good effect, that our knowledge of physicality grants us with no examples of matter creating itself, if one excludes the origin of the universe from consideration. Furthermore, matter cannot result in creation of additional matter without being reduced itself in an amount equal to the result. Therefore, they would argue, for the universe to have come into existence, it would require the involvement of an agent or force that is exempt from the laws of physicality. Of course, their particular God is assumed to be the aforementioned agent or force. Now, neither side can come to agreement as to whether or not this argument actually holds water. And ultimately, it comes down to this. One of two things happens to be the case. A, the physical universe, or universes, either exist in and of itself, or B, there exists or existed a non-physical entity that resides in some reality other than our own and has both the ability and desire to create our universe. Now, based upon our experiences and observations, both are completely impossible. However, one of them had to have happened. If one denies one of these possibilities based upon the fact that it could not, to our knowledge, have occurred, then they must affirm an equally impossible alternative. Now, is the truth of God's existence as simple as a flip of a coin? Of course not. But of these alternatives, one is 100% true, while the other is 100% false. And most likely, that question is never to be answered. Now, the problem is that in debates with theists, there is no such thing as a tie, as they feel no need to prove God's existence, and are content in assuming that in the absence of 100% proof to the contrary, God does exist. Again, specifically, their God. In other words, to the theist, God exists because you cannot prove he does not. Literally, for some theists, short of observable evidence of God's non-existence, impossible by definition, there is no method of argument that will convince them that a God does not exist. And again, to them, our, quote, failure to prove that God does not exist is viewed as evidence for its existence. Sadly, the chattel that make up the substantial majority of their faiths see things the same way, and that in observing that the atheist was unable to prove to a 100% degree of certainty that God does not exist, their faith is strengthened. Thus, I argue that we should not feel compelled to engage in such arguments in the future, but rather, we should concentrate our efforts in proving that their specific God does not exist. A far easier task, in my opinion. Obviously, no theist argues for the existence of a God that is not their own. And by arguing that the universe had to have a creator, they of course assume that their God is that creator. But there is a substantial difference between being able to prove, I say in quotes, that the universe was created and that this creator is in fact the God of their particular faith. For too long, we non-believers have been debating the wrong side of this argument. Let them have their creator. We cannot convince them otherwise. But we can prove, in my opinion, that this creator is not their God. This is the very goal that I will now dedicate my next several episodes to, proving that the God of Christianity is in fact a lie. Now, given the enormity of the efforts that have preceded mine, I must admit from the start that there is likely little original left to be said on the subject. Nonetheless, I am going to go forward in an effort to give my best take on the best arguments against Christianity. Sayest the Christian, but you do claim that there is no such thing as moral truth, do you not? What I mean by this is that the Holocaust was wrong regardless of whether any of us agree or not. You reject universal objective truth, do you not? Sayest I believe that there are things that are true. One thing that is true is that most people, regardless of their religious allegiance, do not wish to live in an environment where people are allowed to harm one another without consequence. In fact, the few people who do want such a thing tend to be religious extremists. Most of us wish to live in an environment where we will be allowed to live peacefully with the freedom to live as we would please, with the understanding that there are necessary limits to this freedom. People don't wish to live in chaos and do understand that actions have consequences. While I do reject universal truths in terms of morality, morality cannot be found under a microscope, I can honestly claim that the Holocaust was wrong. Now, of course, the Germany and Austria in which these crimes occurred were heavily Christian at the time. I personally can see no historical evidence that moral absolutes, if they exist, have ever honestly had any impact upon our behavior as a species, and it causes me to wonder why it is we assume that they exist in the first place. I reject the Holocaust for the same reason that I opposed the genocide inflicted upon the Medians and the inhabitants of Jericho. Read the Old Testament if you are wondering about these references. A world in which such behavior is permitted is a very dangerous world for all of its inhabitants. That would include me. Sayest the Christian, this is basically true, but I would add that while some people don't want to be harmed personally and might practice acts of charity, I doubt that most people generally care about those outside of their immediate family and chosen friends. Though they might like to make others think so for the sake of appearances. There are violent people who use religion as a banner of triumph. There has also been many people in history that have used atheism and naturalism as a banner of triumph and as an excuse for evil. In fact, in a world where people do not believe in the truth of moral values, there is more than enough fertile grounds for the growth of inhuman ignorance. I suggest you read history, and then you will not make such biased misrepresentations. Sayest I, while I don't agree that all instances of charity and kindness are for premeditated Darwinian purposes, There is some truth to the claim that people will act for the sake of appearances. Evolutionists make this claim routinely and view this tendency as a key aspect of sexual selection. There are benefits to appearing to be a good, kind, moral person, which exist both within a Darwinian point of view and a theistic point of view. While I agree that there have been atheists who have committed acts of evil, I can think of few, none actually, who have done so in the name of atheism. History is filled with atrocities committed in the name of a god. Says the Christian, "You cannot claim that the Holocaust is evil. You can merely say that you personally dislike that kind of behavior. The Holocaust, in a world without objective truth, is taboo, nothing more." Sayest I, "Yes, I can. Again, the permission of such behavior has consequences for us all. A world in which such disregard for human life was considered the norm or acceptable would not be a world in which I would choose to live. Such a world would be chaotic and extremely dangerous to us all. Ultimately, my morality is a selfish one, as I for my own selfish reasons do not wish to live in a world where cruelty and hatred are considered acceptable. One never knows when one will be the victim of such cruelty and hatred." Sayest the Christian, "The world in which you believe in, human beings have no more objective value than a slug. So you cannot expect people to treat your existence with any more respect than they choose to." Sayest I, "True, I selfishly attach value to the species to which I am a member. So in a sense you are correct. So what? You are correct that I cannot expect people to treat my existence with any more respect than they choose to. I'm not sure what this statement proves, as it is true whether there is a God or not. Ultimately, I can say this. History provides us with little evidence that religion improves our existence on this tiny rock, orbiting a tiny star, drifting along with the whole of the Milky Way inside our ever-expanding universe. At best, religion has the opiate effect as described to us by Marx. Perhaps it allows us to endure with the hope that we are somehow special while existing inside a universe that cares for absolutely nothing. Ironically, if humanity is to find its salvation from the likely inevitable death that awaits our species, it will not be a god providing it, but rather the very science that most theists now accuse of villainies. I will say this, if I could be convinced that religion is in fact of value to our species, that we are better off with it than without it, then I would stand aside and allow our species to enjoy the bliss of its ignorance. However, I have not been convinced of this, and in fact have been convinced of very much the opposite, and I believe that, as is typically the case, bliss does not come with ignorance. With ignorance comes fear, hatred, superstition, and suffering, not bliss. Ultimately, humanity, human life, has the value we give it. And I value my life and the lives of those that I love and care for, and thus I can be said to be a humanist." Sayest the Christian, "There are clues that point towards theism. For instance, all healthy-minded people experience a capacity for guilt, which is activated when we are given reason to believe that something about our behavior is immoral. Though it is true that one can be deceived about right and wrong, we all have a basic understanding of it. We universally agree and take granted that there is such a thing as right and wrong, honor and virtue. Thus, the mere fact that we have a moral conscience would suggest that there is such a thing as an objective wrong, despite a universal disagreement about what that might be. It seems a rather bizarre coincidence that among the other senses we have, a sense of guilt, which, like the others, coincides with the objective reality, more specifically, with that aspect of reality concerning our free choices. Seems to me that we have a sixth sense. It's called a moral conscience. Sayest I, the existence of a moral conscience can be explained, and has been explained, in completely evolutionary terms. Obviously, if we were each psychopaths, that is, unrestrained in our willingness to inflict harm and death upon our fellow human beings, that would undeniably have a tremendous and negative impact upon our survivability as a species. The fact that 90% of us have an innate urge not to inflict harm upon our neighbors can not only be explained in Darwinian terms, but can be best explained in Darwinian terms. Certainly, you can admit that a species that coexists peacefully and works collaboratively has a better chance of survival than a species that indiscriminately preys upon itself. Guilt would be just one of the mechanisms through which this reality is accomplished. But what precisely is guilt? You have claimed that, quote, "It seems a rather bizarre coincidence that among the other senses we have a sense of guilt, which, like the others, coincides with an objective reality, more specifically, with that aspect of reality concerning our free choices." You go on to say that it seems that we have a sixth sense called moral conscience. You are correct, as most humans do in fact feel guilt when they believe they have harmed another or done something wrong. How is it that we feel this, and just how is it that we know just what it is we should feel guilt about? Well, in essence, guilt is nothing more than a variety of empathy, which, as defined by the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary, is the action of understanding, being aware of, being sensitive to, and vicariously experiencing the feelings, thoughts, and experience of others of either the past or the present, without having the feelings, thoughts, and experience fully communicated in an objectively explicit manner. Guilt is the sorrow we feel when others suffer because of our actions. But, as you point out, how is it that our feelings of guilt always seem to correspond with our knowledge of right and wrong? The answer is almost laughably simple. We know when to feel guilty because we know what harms us personally. In other words, I know that I do not like being punched in the face. Because of this knowledge, I rightfully assume that others have the same attitude and experiences when being punched in the face themselves. Were I to punch someone in the face, I am able to empathize with the victim of said punch. That is, I can identify with the pain the victim has experienced when it was punched. And for that, I feel a certain degree of sorrow. To one degree or the other, I would share in the suffering of the victim regardless as to whether I threw the punch or not. This is empathy. However, this sorrow is amplified by the fact that I personally inflicted the pain upon the unfortunate victim. This amplified sense of sorrow is precisely what guilt is, and it can range anywhere from a mild sense of melancholy to a lifelong sense of anguish. As you can see, there is nothing magical about how it is we know what to feel guilty about. We know when to feel guilt because we have an understanding of just how our actions would affect others because we know how those same actions would affect ourselves. Essentially, guilt is empathy plus personal responsibility. Now, a better question than why it is we feel guilt would be, why do we feel empathy? There is still much to be learned about empathy, about what it is and why it is. The scientific consensus appears to be that it is an autonomic biochemical response and that it is an essential component to social discourse and interaction. Most autistics would tell you, if they can, that it is extremely difficult to become socially integrated when you are completely oblivious to the concerns and feelings of others. The psychological nature of empathy can be researched easily by anyone with access to a library or a connection to the internet. How exactly it resulted from evolution is and will always remain a mystery. But why it evolved should be obvious to each of us. The most fundamental benefits of empathy are made clear in the following example. You see a fellow human dangling from a cliff. Your empathy for the plight of the dangling human leads you to rush over and pull him to safety. And in doing so, you've just saved the life of a human who may later go on to propagate sexually, and thus increasing the survivability of the species. Furthermore, by having saved a fellow human, you become viewed as a hero and more desirable to members of the opposite sex, and thus increase your chance of propagating sexually yourself. Empathy has a direct effect upon a species' survivability, and an effect upon an individual's social status, which can directly improve his, usually it is the male, chance of passing on his genes. Let's look at another possible event where multiple emotions are at play. You happen upon a fellow human being who is being attacked by a bear. Because of empathy, you have a strong desire to save the man from his gruesome fate. Fear, on the other hand, makes you hesitant to risk the same fate to save another human. On this occasion, you flee for safety, and while you feel guilt for your inaction, you are still very much alive yourself. In this situation, fear trumps empathy, and as a result, only one human is eliminated from the genetic pool, whereas, had you rushed in to play the hero, likely two genetic agents would have been removed. A willingness to act for the betterment of one's entire culture or species cannot help but to have improved our chances of surviving as a species. And these facts remain relevant even today. Of course, not all of our urges conformed to the accepted Christian notion of morality. It is a known fact that most humans, particularly males of our species, routinely experience lustful urges to engage in carnal acts with the immediate object of our desires. And these urges give no consideration to the morality of their existence, or to whether or not the object of our desires is our spouse. Christian theologians have already acknowledged early on our evil and innate lust. In fact, if you look at all of the deadly sins, they each stem from our innate tendency to, quote, sin, our internal tendency to fall short of what your God demands of us. Any claim that we have a sixth sense leading us to do good must be countered by the notion that we also have, in the eyes of most Christians, a seventh sense leading us to do evil. Says the Christian, the fact is, most of the freedoms we enjoy is based upon a belief in transcendental ethics. If people avoid wrong, they avoid it because they believe that their behavior is truly wrong, and thus they cannot stand to be wrong. The atheist is the same, except they hold these ethical beliefs irrationally. Sayest I, to the uneducated, such an inference may seem to be the case, but a modest understanding of the truths of evolution quickly and easily provide an alternate to the theist's favorite explanation for everything. God did it. There is nothing irrational about the knowledge that one's greatest hope to live a happy and peaceful life is to live in a happy and peaceful world. Sayest the Christian, when we are forced to see the irrationality of it, rather than accept the inference of God's existence, atheists choose to disbelieve in moral truth altogether. Now, imagine a world where people no longer infer those values on people. Such is the danger of promoting naturalism, and even more foolish is such an endeavor when we have no evidence to support a naturalistic worldview. I find it quite disturbing that people would want to promote it. Perhaps they believe naturalism provides certain freedoms they would not have in a strictly moral climate. Sayest I. This is a completely different argument altogether. Now, I've already explained briefly just how it is that morality could and did develop via Darwinian methodology. But now you're arguing that there are frightful consequences to a world where people no longer infer those values on other people. Perhaps, but you've already asserted that these values are intrinsic and found in each of us and given to us by God. So how could such a thing actually occur if your previous theory is correct? The claim that we have no evidence to support a naturalistic worldview is true in much the same manner as the claim that we have no evidence as to the existence of the sun. In truth, what we have no evidence of is the existence of a God. Now, a God may very well exist, but I see no evidence of that fact. We naturalists promote naturalism for two reasons. A, it is in fact the truth, and accepting that fact just makes sense. B, we've seen the benefits of religion, and quite frankly, we wish to have nothing more to do with it. We've seen the jihads and crusades, the witch burnings, and the hatred of knowledge that comes with a belief in a God, and we've had enough. We believe, and evidence seems to confirm this, that a superior morality, that is, a morality in which life is actually respected and treated with compassion, comes in the absence of a God. Mankind's greatest hope lies not in our superstitions, but in science and knowledge. Again, the claim that evolution explains nothing is a claim made in ignorance. Evolution can and has explained everything that you have just suggested it does not. You just have to be willing to open your mind to the truth. Sayest the Christian, pointless debate to confuse the unwary. God is truth. What is not truth is a lie. Lies are from the liar. Do not give the liar a moment of your time. Do not engage the liar in debate, for he is very old and very clever, and he wants your soul very much. All the liar has to do is to have you cast your eyes momentarily from the truth. The liar tempts us to imagine a truth without God. There is no truth outside of truth himself. God is that truth. Sayest I. Initially, I was taken back by the inanity of your comments, but then I realized that it allowed me the opportunity to segue to what I feel is the basis for most religious belief. I believe that it is, to a varying degree, a product of a mental disorder. Like your typical theist, a person with personality disorder cannot recognize the condition in themselves, though they can see it in others clearly, and are almost always incapable of admitting their own condition. In fact, ironically, the best indication that a person does not have a personality disorder would be for them to admit that they do. In the same manner, theists can determine if their beliefs are intellectual in nature or the result of a disorder if they can honestly admit that they might be wrong. Most theists are perfectly capable of understanding the absurdity of every competing faith, but utterly unaware of the absurdity of their own. As a non-believer, I personally have no problem honestly admitting that there might actually be a God. Now, as a theist, ask yourself this question. Is it possible that my God does not exist? Not that it doesn't exist, but just that conceivably it might not. I suggest that if you honestly lack the ability to concede the possibility that there might not be a God, then your faith is the result of a disorder. The origins of morality. To most theists, Christians in particular, the notion that humanity could exist under the aegis of a moral code that did not originate in God is utterly inconceivable. Without a code of behavior defined by their God, by what means could we possess a moral standard? How could concepts of good and evil possibly exist or be known to any of us in a universe that is void a higher power? Of course, this attitude exists under two very false assumptions. A, that a code of morality requires an objective, predefined source, and B, a God can be trusted to develop a code of behavior that has our, not his, interests at heart. Now, in case A, they might have a point, not necessarily a good point, but a point nonetheless. Where does morality come from, if not a God? Well, in a sense, our morality does have an objectiveness to it, that being the human condition. We're all humans. We all share a large number of things in common, and a basic realization that in order to achieve our most minimal desires, we have to play by the rules that will get us there. Now, if we could achieve our goals by robbing and raping everyone we come across, then perhaps that's how we would behave. But of course, a species that incessantly preys upon itself can only go so far in a Darwinian sense. In truth, there is within the majority of the members of our species an intrinsic abhorrence of chaos, wanton violence, and what we would call antisocial behavior in general. The Christians assert that this innate avoidance of disorder and selfishness could only come from a God. But they make this claim despite the obvious fact that this innate morality can and does come about via evolutionary mechanisms. Again, a species that preys upon itself has a greatly reduced chance to survive as a whole, and a species that can act collaboratively and in unison to meet its goals and overcome its challenges, a species that can do this increases its odds of surviving exponentially. This is achieved to a large extent via our emotions, which are nothing more than biochemical reactions to certain stimuli. Love, pride, jealousy, remorse, even empathy, combined with our natural maternal and paternal instincts, are again nothing but biochemical responses to stimuli, which at one time or the other had and still have an effect upon our survivability as individuals and as a species. This is a biological fact. Our emotional urges are physical rather than spiritual in nature. Now, maybe God gave us these urges, along with virtually every other mammal on the planet, but the existence of a God is not necessary to explain why we have them. However, what is easy to see is just how maternal and paternal instincts, as well as our emotions, can be and are the foundation upon which our morality is based. Maternal and paternal instincts can lead one to have what would otherwise be an irrational attachment and concern for another member of one's species, specifically one's child. This attachment greatly enhances that child's chance of surviving, and thus greatly enhances the chance that the genetic codes of the mother and father will be passed along to future generations. Fear of death and injury can lead one to form partnerships with others who share their circumstances and characteristics, with the understanding that existing in unison with one's clan or tribe can greatly increase both their and their child's chances of survival. Individual acts of altruism and heroism can lead to the strengthening of the species as a whole in manners which should be obvious to us all. Guilt can make us hesitant to do harm to fellow members of our species, even when we would benefit as an individual, but the species would suffer as a whole. I could go on. These are all known biochemical realities, and while one may insist upon attributing their existence to a god, God is a nonetheless unnecessary inclusion, as their existence can be explained without a single mention of a first cause. That is God. Now, precisely how these emotions actually developed is and will remain a mystery, as there is no means by which the circumstances behind their origin can be recreated. However, science can tell us just how they could have developed. Each of these biochemical reactions drove our forefathers to exist in unison in a world where death and dismemberment was a day-to-day reality. Aided by our intellect, humanity slowly evolved a code of what is considered acceptable behavior. A code which appears to have at its heart the survival of our particular individual sociological groups, from family to village to nation to species. In truth, our behavior is probably affected as much by our intellect as our emotions. Virtually every conscious creature on the planet shares with us to varying degrees the same emotions that we feel. Even altruism, some studies have shown. However, none of these other species can be said to have as elaborate a sense of morality as does ours. Most of the other inhabitants of the planet seem to base their actions largely upon instinctive responses to stimuli, although it is wholly inaccurate to think that cognition plays no role in their behavior. Whereas, our behavior seems to be affected as much by our intellect as any other factor. Why is this? Even as emotional responses played a key role in our survival as a species, particularly early on, they are at the same time limiting when they control us. One of the factors that can be said to separate humans from animals is our ability to overcome our emotions. For good or bad, we can elevate ourselves above the base emotions that we share with nearly each of our fellow mammal brothers and sisters. It is the ability to, in a sense, define a response to a situation rather than allow the situation to define us. It is true that among multi-celled organisms on this planet, humanity has achieved supremacy. The supremacy is the direct result of the intellectual capabilities that our brain provides us, which is in turn the direct result of eons of evolution. The more complicated and capable the brain of a species is, the more complicated and extravagant its desires become. Lower species seek only to consume, reproduce, and survive. That's all they know, that's all they care about. The more complicated the brain, the more complicated the desires. A dog will seek to consume and reproduce, but will also seek to develop emotional bonds with others. Sometimes they are very deep bonds. Dogs will also seek to be entertained. Humans, whose brains are far more developed than a dog's, will also seek these things, but will have other intellectual pursuits when given the chance. Humans will attempt to answer the questions that a dog could never even conceive of, and seek knowledge the dog would have no interest in. Maslow does an excellent job of describing what drives the average human, individual, and society, and under what circumstances a human will elevate what he perceives he has need of. Morality is the behavior that we perceive can place humanity in a position where it can pursue those needs, whether real or perceived. To one extent, whether morality affects our survivability as a species or not is somewhat irrelevant, but rather it is a consequence of the development of our species. Morality is the consensus as to what will and will not make our existence here on Earth as close to pleasant as possible. We know that we don't like to be killed, so we make rules against it. We know that we don't like to be tortured, so we make rules against it. We know that we don't like to be enslaved, so we make rules against it. Selfishly, we know that while the rules prohibit us from acting upon our every whim, if said whims involve doing harm to others, they also protect us from being the target of the whims of others. However, sometimes we selfishly protect only those who share our characteristics. For example, race, religion, gender, economic status, nationality. And sometimes we make the enlightened decision to protect everyone equally. Sadly, sometimes we have no say in the matter, as our code of morality can be hijacked by dictatorships, religious beliefs, and occasionally a constitution-based law system. Of course, some people may not care about protecting others, but will at the same time understand that living within the bounds of a moral consensus is their best chance of living a happy and fulfilling life, as the punishment associated with refusing will often exceed the reward of acting as they wish. Intellect, or cognition, is essentially the ability to recognize the relationship between cause and effect. And while psychopaths may lack the ability to care about the impact their actions have upon others, they nonetheless understand that indiscriminate act of violence will eventually have consequence that even a psychopath would likely prefer to avoid. As a consequence, a psychopath will likely curb his behavior to reflect, at least publicly, his compliance with the social mores of his particular culture. Now, some people will correctly point out that a secular-based moral consensus is not consistent with anything other than the current perceptions and attitudes of society. But at the same time, some things will never change. Humans do not like being killed, tortured, disrespected, or robbed, and etc. And to that extent, our morality will possess a certain degree of consistency, as it will likely reflect these truths. Now, in a perfect world, we would all be able to live according to how we see fit. And if the theist notion that we all have an innate knowledge of right and wrong given to us by God were true, this might be a possibility. Clearly, this is not the case, as the majority of our urges do not fit the traditional Christian notion of righteousness. It is a known fact that most humans, particularly the males of the species, routinely experience lustful urges to engage in carnal acts with the immediate object of our desires. And these urges give no consideration to the morality of their existence, or to whether or not the object of our desires is our spouse. Christian theologians have acknowledged early on our evil and innate lust. In fact, look at all of the deadly sins. They each stem from our innate tendency to offend the God of Abraham, our internal desire to fall short of what their God demands of us. There is literally zero evidence that we have a natural knowledge of how the God of Christianity wishes us to behave, or that this knowledge somehow exists in our subconscious. As is usually the case with theists, in the absence of a precise explanation as to how something could exist, in this case morality, the assumption is always that God is the cause. Humans have always had a need to explain the inexplicable, and in the absence of a coherent alternative explanation, it can be understood why God has always been the default. From where do babies come from to what is lightning, humans have never been content to admit they just don't know the answer. In the past, God has been the answer to every question, up until the point that a plausible alternative explanation has come to light. Now, as science continues to find an explanation for everything, God is found to be no longer needed to explain anything. And in a sense, the second Darwin explained the origin of species, God died. Well, at the very least, with Darwin, God's existence became superfluous. Anyway, back to morality. As we all know, frequently, while in the pursuit of one's desires, an individual's actions, whether intentional or not, may come to interfere with one's ability to live their life in peace. A moral consensus must be developed in such situations to determine whose rights would take precedence. Also, there are times when a consensus must be developed when it becomes clear, or at least perceived, that a behavior which once seemed acceptable turns out to have consequences that were not originally considered. For example, violent movies. Originally, many people thought that what goes on in the privacy of one's own home is no one else's business. But what if it turns out that allowing children to watch violent movies makes them more prone towards violence when they grow up? In such a situation, a consensus could develop that such media should be strictly limited to adults or banned altogether. The same thing could also happen even if in reality these forms of media had no real effect upon a person's disposition towards violence at all. Sometimes a moral consensus is based upon nothing more than perception. Ultimately, there are countless things that affect a community's morality. Primary among these factors is where the community as a whole lies within Maslow's hierarchy. Essentially, the more evolved a species' intellect is, the greater the desire of each member of the species to exist in an orderly and peaceful environment, and the greater its intellect, the more likely it is to figure out how to accomplish this. Morality, which is the means towards that end, is naught but our understanding of how we wish to live and how best to achieve that goal. Morality has nothing to do with intrinsic goods and evils. Our intellect is the result of our evolution, and our morality is the result of our intellect in combination with the previous mentioned autonomous biochemical reactions. Freud does an excellent job of explaining this relationship in his concept of the personality, id, ego, and superego, which he himself based upon the Platonic concept of the soul, intellect, spirit, and appetite. If somewhere in this universe there is a species with a greater intellect than our own, not too hard to imagine, then it may have developed a better understanding of how to exist in peace and harmony, and thus one could argue that they were morally superior to ourselves. Whether that species exists or not, who knows? Of course, we don't consciously make decisions based upon whether or not it fits the Darwinian definition of survivability. In fact, for good or bad, I believe that the evolution of our intellect allowed our species to move to the point where each of our actions are no longer carefully balanced, instinctive, and emotional responses. I differ from the majority of evolutionists in that I do not assume that every aspect of our morality is a direct result of Darwinian causality. I believe that while evolution has led us to our current level of intellectual development, we now make decisions that go beyond the mere survival of our species. We are often inspired to act in manners that are not directed solely by our urges to gather food and reproduce. For good or bad, human intellect has risen above the meager concerns of our pre-human ancestors. In a sense, we motivate ourselves. While our actions are the result of strict determinism, the factors that influence our actions are so elaborate and incalculable and so specific to each individual that we do, in fact, have a de facto free will. Examples of our intellect's revolt against our Darwinian urges can be seen daily. As a species, we've nearly perfected the methods of enjoying the pleasures of coitus while not being burdened by its fruits. Humans routinely take actions that intentionally bring about their own demise by committing what we know as suicide, sometimes for a cause, but usually not. Humans in search of a source of exhilaration will intentionally seek to experience fear and terror, a uniquely human urge, and will, when necessary, expose themselves to the potential of death or dismemberment to accomplish this. Clearly, all of our actions cannot be explained by purely Darwinian rationales. But this is not to say that they no longer have any impact upon our behavior, as clearly they do. But it is to say that our behavior is not solely dictated by these factors. We make decisions based upon our flawed understanding of how they will benefit us and our loved ones. However, merely because our behavior seems to be influenced at times by factors no longer directly connected to evolutionary mechanics does not mean these mechanics are no longer present. Evolution is always a work in progress, and never could it be said that a species has completed its evolution. It is just a series of usually beneficial accidents that currently can neither be predicted nor controlled. Furthermore, evolution is not a process that leads to our perfection as a species. Evolution is a process that is driven by our ability to sexually propagate, and to the extent that our intellect enhances this outcome, we can expect our intellect to continue to evolve. Should our intellect eventually become a detriment to this process, as in some regards it appears to be, our intellect would then begin to recede, and our sense of morality would be affected as a result. Our present level of intellect gives us the ability to strive towards the reality we perceive as best suiting our needs. But it is not necessarily sufficient to accomplish this reality. Our efforts are still limited by many things, not the least of which are the limits of our intellect. Superstition and emotion still control many of our decisions and cloud our perceptions of reality. Environment, both physical and political, and access to resources also play a significant role in our ability to exist as we would choose. What we value is not intrinsic, but rather subjective and based upon our needs, both real and perceived. Obviously, a man who is locked in a cell may be less concerned about his right to vote than his own physical freedom. Once freed, that same man may willingly re-enter that same cell if it means he'll have access to food and water if otherwise he did not. Our values are as much based upon our circumstances in this world as any other factor. But again, since we all have things in common, we should expect to all have a certain number of similar values. Again, most of us fear death. No sane person likes pain, etc. These realities are going to influence the moral consensus of all societies to one extent or the other. Ultimately, every aspect of human behavior and morality, even empathy, can be and has been explained in purely physiological and psychological terms. Of course, this does not mean that there is not a God, but absolutely and undeniably, morality would exist without one. Of course, Christians insist that this is false and that without an intimate knowledge of the Holy Bible and an abiding fear of the afterlife, no human can be consistently and honestly moral. But what can be said of the millions and millions of atheists that behave morally and do good works without the benefit of the belief in a God and whose behavior cannot be attributed to a fear of being eternally tortured by an all-loving being? Theists insist that while saintly atheists do in fact exist, their behavior is nonetheless inconsistent with their worldview, that their behavior is in fact influenced by the teachings of Christ and the Holy Bible whether they know it or not. So let us consider the possibility of this claim, that the Bible is in fact our only true source of knowledge, truth, and morality that we have. Is this true? Is the Bible our source of our morality? To test this claim, I'll pit our present moral axioms against the teachings and actions found within the Bible and determine if we do, in fact, get our morality from this book. For the purposes of this examination, we will assume that the absurdly ridiculous tales of the Bible are, in fact, true. Genocide. According to international law, genocide is defined as any of the following acts committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethical, racial, or religious group, as such, killing members of the group, b, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, c, deliberately inflicting upon the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or part, d, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, e, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Now, to most people, there is nothing to disagree with, as this definition and concept is universal. Attempting to destroy an entire culture is wrong, regardless of the motives. Seriously, who disagrees with this? Well, as it turns out, the God of the Bible was not at all adverse to urging his followers to commit acts that would easily fit within the accepted definition of genocide. In fact, he himself, on more than one occasion, committed this particular crime. In the biblical tale of the Great Flood, we have the most famous incident of genocide in history. This atrocity was committed because God was angry with the humans he had created because they were guilty of some unspecified wickedness. And what is it that the God of Christianity does to people when he's angry? He brutally kills them. Of course, in this instance, he brutally killed what would have been millions of humans and destroys dozens, if not hundreds, of cultures. Bizarrely, this act of genocide is held up by most Christians as a superb example of God's love, mercy, and justice, since the 99.99999% of the humans who had displeased God somehow deserved the cruel and unusual punishment that they received, as did what would have been billions of animals. And God did, after all, opt to spare the tiny fraction of 1% of us who did not fill him with hatred and loathing. Sure, some people will argue that maybe God could have handled the situation a little differently, and that drowning 20 to 30 million humans and billions of animals shouldn't be considered the solution to every problem. But fortunately, when it was all over, God figured this out and promised to never drown everyone again. Sodom and Gomorrah. God's hatred for humanity returns when he decides to destroy the pretend cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Angered by the wicked behavior, read sexual immorality, of the residents of these proud cities, God can no longer suffer their existence and plans to destroy the cities outright. Fortunately, the prophet, formerly known as Abram, successfully negotiates God into agreeing to spare the few righteous men that might be found in the cities. Women are given no such consideration. As a result, God sends two angels disguised as human males into Sodom to investigate the situation. Christians claim that this demonstrates God's mercy, but in truth merely serves as proof that their God is, in fact, not omniscient. The angels immediately run into the hero of this tale, the godly Lot. Lot urges the two strange men to spend the night with him, where he will gladly wash their feet. The angels may have initially assumed that Lot was the very type of person they were no doubt told to expect, but eventually they agree to spend the night with Lot. Shortly after arriving at Lot's residence, every male in the city, both young and old, show up and literally insist upon having sex with the strangers. Allow me to repeat. Every male in the city, this includes infants, show up at Lot's house and demand to have sex with the newly arrived strangers. The author of this tale makes certain to clarify that it was in fact every male in the city, again, regardless of age, who demanded to rape the men. This fact allows the author to justify the slaughter of the children who were to perish in God's fiery wrath, since after all, they were just as guilty as everyone else. The fact that 2-year-old boys demanding to rape adult males is patently absurd seems to be given less consideration than the fact that God needed to seem justified in committing mass acts of infanticide. Anyway, Lot, being the good father that he was, tosses his 2 daughters to the crowd and urges the crowd to rape them rather than the 2 men that he had just met minutes prior. Ultimately, this incident is all the evidence that God needs, and he decides to destroy the 2 cities post-haste. Lot and family are allowed to flee his fiery wrath. Apparently, Sodom was so evil that God felt justified in destroying Gomorrah without checking it for righteous men. I guess this was simply because of Gomorrah's proximity to Sodom. The cities were destroyed in a hail of fire and brimstone, and sadly, Lot's wife made the horrible mistake of looking back and was herself turned into a pillar of salt. This is a sin which, for some reason, failed to make the 10 Commandments. Thou shalt not look as God doth commit genocide. Later in the tale, Lot's daughters, who had to be still dealing with the trauma of being offered up for rape by their father, they trick Dad into getting them pregnant. Yeah. Amazingly, these are the people that God opted to spare. The Amalekites. Now, next on the list for extermination were the Amalekites, whom God hated. Apparently, as the Israelites were making their exodus from Egypt to the Holy Land, a band of Amalekites attacked a group of Israelis who happened to be lagging behind the main group. Naturally, God felt that genocide would be the only proper response. After a very lengthy series of military campaigns, one in which Moses was for some inexplicable reason obligated to hold his staff above his head, King David was eventually able to fulfill God's demand to, and I quote, kill both man and woman, and infant, ox, sheep, camel, and donkey. Samuel, the first book of Samuel, chapter 15, verses 2-3. Interestingly, King David became the king of the Israelites because his predecessor, King Saul, hesitated to enact God's will with a satisfactory level of brutality, and thus he was relieved of his rank. Unfortunately for Saul, he foolishly opted to spare the Amalekite king and some of their healthier cattle and sheep. And this failure horribly grieved God, who at the time had no taste for acts of mercy, and was not about to make an exception here. Saul, for his failure to sacrifice every animal to God in a burnt offering, which God doth delight, was removed from his position as king of Israel. Christians are, of course, content with God's genocidal verdict, as the Amalekites did, after all, attack the aforementioned straggling Israelis. Obviously, no other solution was acceptable in the situation. All of their women and children had to be killed. The Midians. The Israeli treatment of the Midians was particularly sick and tragic, as it was the Midians who took Moses in when he originally fled from Egypt. Moses, who left Egypt after he killed an Egyptian guard, lived among the Midians for 40 years. It was there that he met his wife and raised his children, and was treated as an equal by the Midians. It was also there that he met the Median volcano god, Yahweh. And under its direction, he conspired to free the Hebrews from their enslavement within Egypt. During the Israeli sojourn amidst the Midians, God inflicts upon the Israelis a plague as punishment for their association with the sexually immoral Midianites. God then instructs Moses to take vengeance upon the Midianites for the plague which God himself inflicted upon the Israelis. Moses, in response, summons an army made up of 1,000 warriors from each of the 12 tribes, and they descend upon the unsuspecting Midianites. They fought against Midian and killed every adult male, and this angered God greatly. But it was not the ruthlessness of their attacks that angered him. Yahweh was infuriated by the fact that there were Midian children and women who still lived. He instructed Moses to give his generals a furious tongue-lashing. "Have you allowed all the women to live?" Moses asked them. They were the ones who followed Balaam's advice and were the means of turning the Israelites away from the Lord in what happened at Peor, so that a plague struck the Lord's people. "Now, kill all the boys and kill every woman who has slept with a man, but save for yourself every girl who has never slept with a man." This quote can be found in the book of Numbers. One cannot help but wonder how much worse was the fate of the girls who were spared that day. Amazingly, later in the Bible, the Midianites seem to have shook off their extermination and returned to further bedevil the Israelites in the book of Judges. There, under the leadership of Gideon, 300 Israelis slaughtered 120,000 enemy soldiers, which coincidentally is the estimated population of the entire region at the time, 1,500 of which were slaughtered personally by Gideon after they had surrendered. Interestingly, God instructed Gideon to send home nearly 32,000 warriors prior to the fight, out of fear that his chosen people would give Gideon the credit for the victory rather than God. This was an apparent instance of Yahweh feeling it necessary to prove his existence in order to convince the Hebrews that he was in fact worthy of their worship. For some reason, to accomplish this slaughter, God required the Israelites to blow horns and smash pottery, which appears to have been the source of God's destructive power. No explanation is given for this, and nor can I conceive of a possible reason for it to be necessary. The city of Jericho. The destruction of the city of Jericho was probably the single most unjustifiable act of genocide in recorded human history, as God did not even bother to accuse the residents of Jericho of sexual immorality or a crime of any variety. The residents of Jericho had done nothing to the Israelites and were peacefully minding their own business behind the walls of their proud city. Jericho's sin was to have had the misfortune of having been in the path of the Israeli horde as it traveled towards its promised land. And for that sin, slaughter was the only response. To accomplish this destruction, God instructed Joshua to march around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times, with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have all the people give a loud shout. Then the walls of the city will collapse, and the people will go in, every man straight in. For some reason, blowing horns is again considered a prerequisite to genocide in the Bible. Once again, the walls of Jericho went down. The Israelites poured in, and they devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with sword every living thing in it, men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep, and donkeys. The entire city was sacked, and everything within destroyed or killed. As was typically the case, the servants of the Lord showed no mercy, and the Lord was pleased. Later, God, through his prophet Joshua, further demonstrated his inexplicable hatred for the city by cursing the firstborn of anyone who would dare choose to rebuild Jericho. The flood of Noah, Sodom and Gomorrah, the Amalekites, the Midianites, Jericho. These are just some of the examples of genocide committed at the insistence of the God of the Bible. Thankfully, our modern attitudes towards genocide do not come from this book. This is just one of the examples of evil being committed by the good guys found in the Bible. Most Christians desperately seek to justify the slaughter of entire cultures by claiming that the victims were somehow deserving of their fate, even, if not particularly, their women and children. This while at the same time abhorring genocide themselves. In fact, despite their hesitance to admit that their God was wrong to order these barbaric attacks, I dare say that you cannot find more than a handful of Christians in Western culture who themselves would agree that genocide is even just occasionally acceptable. No, nowadays, with the exception of the most truly demented of their numbers, Western Christians would be as vigorously opposed to genocide as any other sociological category. Nonetheless, it cannot and must not be claimed that this attitude can be found anywhere within the Bible. And without exception, Christians who do rightfully oppose genocide do so despite what the Bible has to say on this topic. Sadly, both the Christians and particularly the Jews would become very intimately familiar with religiously justified persecution and violence in later centuries. Shortly after the time of Jesus, the Jews became intimately familiar with what it was like to be on the wrong side of a genocide, as the Romans responded with extreme prejudice to the Jews' ill-conceived attempts to usurp Roman rule in the region. Humorously, some of the zealots factored in, as part of their plans, the arrival of the foretold Messiah to lead them to victory. Let's take the matter a little further, shall we? Let's examine one of these crimes in light of the Roman Catholic doctrine of a just war. While respected and considered a moral imperative by many, theists and non-theists alike, the just war doctrine defines the conditions under which a war can rightfully be declared and prosecuted. Now, according to this doctrine, and according to the Wikipedia entry of the Just War Doctrine, an entity, normally a state, but for our purposes a god, must meet the following conditions before taking belligerent actions. 1. Just cause. The reason for going to war must be just and cannot, therefore, be solely for recapturing things taken or punishing people who have done wrong. Innocent life must be in imminent danger, and intervention must be to protect life. 2. Comparative justice. While there may be rights and wrongs on all sides of a conflict, to override the presumption against the use of force, the injustice suffered by one party must significantly outweigh that suffered by the other. 3. Legitimate authority. Only duly constituted public authorities may wage war. 4. Right intention. Force may be used only in a truly just cause, and solely for that purpose. Correcting a suffered wrong is considered a right intention, while material gain and retaining economies is not. 5. Probability of success. Arms may not be used in a futile cause, or in a case where disproportionate measures are required to meet or achieve success. 6. Last resort. Force may only be used after all peaceful and viable alternatives have been seriously tried and exhausted, or are clearly not practical. 7. Proportionality. The anticipated benefits of waging a war must be proportionate to its expected evils or harms. Now, before comparing these criteria against God's actions, we are going to assume that God meets criterion 3 and 4. In other words, we'll assume that God is a legitimate authority and possessed a rightful intention. Now, with the remaining 5 criteria, let's examine whether God met the current Christian notion of a just war when causing the Great Flood. Just cause. The principle of just cause clearly indicates that hostile action cannot be justified by the desire to punish people who have done wrong, which was clearly God's motivation for having committed this act. Many Christians will argue that it was not God's desire to inflict harm or to punish, but rather he sought to correct an error that he had made when he created us. The humans, and apparently the animals as well, that God had created were wicked, and God was really hoping for non-wicked humans when he made us. The flood was merely God's method of eliminating this embarrassing error. While one cannot argue with the fact that a God who created the universe and everything contained within would certainly have the prerogative to undo what he had done, one can certainly argue with the methods he opted to use when carrying out this act when one considers the options he had at his disposal. The fact that God opted to drown hundreds of millions of humans and animals when he could have eliminated them in a pain and terror-free manner serves as a pretty clear indication as to what were his true intentions. The act was intended to punish the objects of his failed design, and thus God has failed to meet this particular criteria when he opted to make use of an unnecessary level of brutality, as no amount of brutality was even necessary, to carry out his desire to eliminate life on the planet. In addition to having failed to meet the criteria regarding the motive for resorting to mass acts of violence, God also failed to abide by the mandate that violent intervention be necessary to protect innocent life. Clearly, this was not the case, as not only were no innocent lives at risk if God failed to take action, he undeniably killed countless children who are universally considered to be innocent. And no telling how many pregnant women were killed in the flood. Comparative justice. The principle of comparative justice mandates that the injustice being suffered by the party contemplating the use of violence must outweigh the harm that one must inflict to put an end to said injustice. Again, God comes nowhere near meeting this standard, as he personally was not being harmed or affected in any manner by the actions of the humans and animals he opted to brutally destroy. Probability of success. Hostile action cannot be taken unless the violence has a realistic probability of success. A nation cannot even opt to defend itself from an invading force unless there is a legitimate chance that such actions are not in vain. While one would assume that an all-powerful God would be successful in any endeavor it undertook, God nonetheless laments, after the floodwaters had receded, that his efforts had in fact failed, that humanity, the few of us that remain, was still wicked and inherently so. Interestingly, two paragraphs after admitting this, God reaffirms that he made man in his own image. One does not need to be Sherlock Holmes to deduce what this implies about God's nature. Ultimately, God's purpose for this wicked action, in addition to causing pain and suffering, was the elimination of human wickedness. An omniscient God would have known that his efforts would meet with failure. Just another criteria God has failed to meet. Last resort. As the name of the principle implies, hostile action must be avoided until all legitimate efforts to avoid violence have been exhausted. As God is described as having made no attempts to resolve the situation peacefully, one must conclude that God failed to meet this criteria as well. Now, one might ask just what it is that God could have done to have resolved the situation peacefully. Being omnipotent and omniscient, one would assume that God did in fact have some methods at his disposal. Being neither omnipotent nor omniscient myself, I can personally think of at least one thing he could have done. Instead of slaying all living, breathing creatures right off the bat, God could have made an effort to communicate to us his expectations. Instead, humanity was left to ponder just what it had done to deserve its fate as it was disappearing beneath a planet-consuming flood. There is no indication made within the Bible that God made any effort to educate our ancestors as to his expectations. Nor is there any reason to believe that the victims of this cruel act had any clue that they somehow deserved their fate. Proportionality. I personally cannot find any significant difference between this principle and the principle number 2. The comments I made there apply equally here. You'll find, I'm sure, that none of the aforementioned described acts of genocide fare any better under the just war doctrine than did the Great Flood, as each are completely unjustifiable in light of today's accepted attitudes on genocide and the justification for acts of violence. Well, this will conclude this particular episode of the Agnostic Salvation Hour. I plan to follow up this episode with additional arguments against the validity of Christianity, which will be a pretty lengthy endeavor and is requiring a great deal of effort on my part. I hope you have enjoyed what I've done so far and found it informative. Thank you.